So Anthony, I owe you an apology for my American accent during my piece. You can just forgive
There's no such thing as an American accent, though, is there? It's like saying the Scottish accent.
The Scottish accent or the British accent. Yeah.
The European accent.
I'm already apologising to you.
Which type of American accent are you going to do?
Whatever one comes out. You know, maybe a hybrid of South Korean.
Welcome to It Just So Happened. I am Richard Pulsford, stand-up comedian and rather unprofessional historian. In this show, recorded for the It Just So Happened podcast, we will explore some of the historical people associated with and events which happened on this very day in history, which is the 6th of August. That's before we delve into some of the history of the place where today's show is taking place. So, where are we? Well, it's the city which Time Out magazine last year rated the best in the world. Yes, it's Edinburgh. We're performing today as part of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, the largest annual international arts festival in the world. And our venue this morning is the Hill Street Theatre, situated in Edinburgh's New Town. This historic A-listed building dates back to the 1820s. In 1893, it was purchased by the Masonic Lodge of Edinburgh, Mary's Chapel No. 1, so called because the lodge first met within the old chapel of St. Mary's on Nidris Wynd in Edinburgh. It's designated No. 1 on the roll of lodges of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, as it possesses the oldest existing minute of any Masonic lodge still operating, dating back to 1599, and the first historical reference of a Freemason being initiated as a member in 1634, making it likely to be the oldest Masonic lodge, not only in Scotland, but the world. The building has also been used as a fringe venue for the past 37 years, which makes it the oldest fringe venue constantly in operation. Fittingly, we have an audience with us today, as the fringe welcomes audiences of up to 400,000 people each year, so we welcome about 1/100,000th of that number to this show. So what's drawn in such huge numbers? Well, let me introduce today's panel. Please welcome Marijke Kortenbach, David Cruikshanks and Dr. Anthony Drew. Marijke, you're an improv comedian from the Netherlands, living in Scotland, and you're a member of many improv troupes in Edinburgh, such as the Smoky Monkeys and the Tinderellas. Do you want to tell us anything about those?
Well, as you know, improv groups have weird names. I'm also part of Absolute Improv, which is a TBC improv, a show that's on at 7:45 each night. What can I say? The Tinderellas is an all-female group. We talk about relationships and dating a lot. Improv is fun. You should see some.
Thank you. David Cruikshanks is a comedian and mental health peer worker from Fife. David claims to have had PTSD before it was fashionable and says that as a war veteran, you're legally allowed to herd sheep through your local high street without getting arrested. Is that true?
That's absolutely right, yes. As well as getting the medal for fighting in the Falklands, several places in the UK decided that they would give us the dubious honour of being able to herd livestock through their high street. So, watch this space, because I definitely think it's things to do before you die.
And Dr. Anthony Drew is a New York City-based professor we met 2 minutes ago. A professor by day and a comedian of 6 years standing by night. He describes himself as a generally silly human being, bringing his absurdity to the stage, and is ready to bring his optimistic humour to broader and more diverse audiences around the US. Do you want to say any more about your stand-up comedy?
I am a professor turned comic, because I'm a responsible person, and I did my backup plan first.
Thank you. So that's today's panel, and it's straight over to you, Marijke, for your On This Day piece. Thank you.
Great. I saw the Barbie film yesterday. So this is going to turn into a bit of a feminist rant. I apologize in advance. My first topic is Che Blythe. So on August 6th, Che Blythe from Hawk in Scotland, he set a record by, this was in 1970, sorry, set a record by being the first person to come back from sailing around the world non-stop the wrong way around. So now I think we all know what is the right way, right? It is to the right, yes, it's not to the left. So the right way around is, the easy way around is going east, and going west is a lot harder, and that's why they call it the wrong way around, because of the currents and the wind. So when he returned after 292 days, he had a welcome party of 6,000 people, including the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince of Wales, and the Prime Minister Edward Heath, who said in his speech, "We are proud of the British boat, British built, with British materials, which has carried you so successfully." So apparently Edward Heath was really a fan of British things. For example, trying to restrict workers' rights to strike, and doing U-turns on policies he won the election with. So back to Che. There's something about this story that really pisses me off. I sail myself, and it's not an easy sport. It's quite scary to battle the elements, and it's hard to learn. It would never occur to me, even after 10 years of sailing and teaching kids how to sail, that I could cross a sea by myself, let alone traverse the globe. But Che had never set foot in a sailboat before. He set off to sail around the world the wrong way. He openly admitted that he knew nothing about sailing and navigation, and thought he would just teach himself along the way, which he did. That's the most annoying thing, that he managed it and he came back and bragged about it. The confidence some men have in their own abilities is astounding. Like, they can't seem to find a ketchup bottle if it's hiding behind the pickles. But somehow they manage to traverse and navigate around the world in a dinghy without any experience. And here I am, a woman, wondering if I'm even good enough to have imposter syndrome. The absolute gall of men, right? So, Che Blythe, before his sailing adventure, he managed another great feat. In 1966, he teamed up with his friend, John Ridgway, to row across the Atlantic from Cape Cod to the Aran Islands. They completed this in 92 days, again winning many awards. But Che and John's friendship actually ended after that, and they had a long-running rift that lasted until 2009. In an interview, Che said that he couldn't remember why they stopped speaking in the first place. But I think maybe being in a boat with your friend for 92 days will do that to any friendship. But I think it's great that when men really like something, they do it in such abundance. Like Che and John, they loved rowing so much that they decided to have a 43-year-long one. That's a thinker. So my next topic is Gertrude Ederle. So another great accomplishment, this time by a woman. She became the first woman to swim across the channel on this day in 1926. So as always, the press was highly supportive of women in sports, printing the headline, "England or Drown." Gertrude started swimming at a young age, making it to the Olympics at only 18, winning gold. And 1 year after that, she tried the first time to swim across the channel, but failed, unfortunately. But the next year, she tried again. She had better prepared herself. She had to follow the tide, so you swim in kind of a motion like that. And crucially, she changed her bathing suit. So the traditional woolen one piece is really heavy, and it was very restrictive and caused a lot of chafing. So she fashioned her own bathing suit by making a two-piece. But this was taboo and even illegal in a lot of countries, showing so much skin. So it's great that times have changed, isn't it? Women in sports are no longer being restricted by men about what to wear and how small their clothing is. Even the opposite, with the Norwegian women's beach handball team getting fined for wearing shorts instead of bikini bottoms. A victory for women. So Gertrude made the swim in just over 14 hours, being supported by a tugboat full of her family, the press, and a supply of chicken legs, oranges, and soup to sustain her. Sounds like my hangover order from Deliveroo. But the press again was very supportive on this day. In a second tugboat, there were reporters from rival newspapers because she had an exclusive with the New York Daily News. The second tugboat was filled with disgruntled reporters and followed behind it. and they sometimes came dangerously close, endangering her chances. sorry, the English press actually accused Ederle of being sheltered by the two boats, thus making her swim easier. Another great reporting of women in sports. And one journalist actually was so eager to win the scoop that he jumped in the water before her boat arrived and swam to the nearest pub to file his story over the phone. I just love that. But meanwhile, Ederle was exhausted, stung by jellyfish, had a tongue so swollen by the salty water that she could barely speak. And you'd expect that she would be received by a crowd of enthusiasts like Che, right? Like maybe a government official talking about how American-made things are amazing. But no, not for Ederle. The first person to greet her after her fantastic record was a British immigration officer demanding to see her passport before sending her back to her home country. So nothing has really changed.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you. So I'm going to do an On This Day piece, so questions to the panel. So first one, how did Solomon August Andres try to reach the North Pole in
1897?
Uber?
bobsled.
Seems reasonable.
The doggy sled, what do they call that?
No, it was actually by hydrogen balloon. Mm. And what country sponsored his expedition? Take a random guess at that.
Germany.
The USSR.
Wales.
Like you're thinking, Sweden. Andre was an engineer in the patents office in Stockholm. He proposed a plan for letting the wind propel a hydrogen balloon across the Arctic Sea to the Bering Strait to fetch up in Alaska, Canada or Russia, and passing near or even right over the North Pole on the way. He bought his own test balloon, the Svea, in 1893 and made 9 journeys in it from Stockholm and Gothenburg. But each time he found that he was carried uncontrollably out to the Baltic Sea and even as far as Finland and was often dangerously close to the water and to rocks. He was convinced that he could alter the course of the balloon by using drag ropes, albeit by only 10 degrees from the wind direction. But this technique has since been proved as completely ineffective. Yet the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences was persuaded to fund a proposed 30-day hydrogen balloon trip. His steerable silk balloon would carry 3 people, provisions for 4 months, equipment and ballast weighing 3,000 kilos. And they could keep going day and night in the Arctic summer. Where do you think the balloon was made?
China.
Who's got a history of balloons and...
Oh, France, maybe.
France, that's the
France.
One, yes. So Paris was the capital of the ballooning world, so it's made in a workshop there, run by Henri Lachambre. And the balloon was called Urnen, if that's how you say it, which means eagle. Now, think about this. How did they cook food on their journey with a hydrogen balloon?
Carefully.
It's as good as answer as any, isn't it? Yeah.
Did George Foreman have been cooking?
So what, they designed a primus stove which would hang 8 metres underneath the balloon and which could be lit from the basket. What kind of problems do you think Andre encountered which he'd not planned for given this trip?
How to use the toilet.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
His moustache was frozen?
Possibly. High humidity led to ice and snow on the balloon, which added to the total weight. And then hydrogen leaked from the balloon's 8 million stitches. And also the crew were not physically fit. They had no survival skills training. So how far do you think his first expedition got from the island of Svalbard, given all this information?
Ooh.
Like an hour?
It didn't leave at all. The wind direction stayed constant from the north, and one of his crew, Nils Gustav Ekholm, then quit when he realised the balloon was leaking hydrogen so quickly that it just wouldn't last the whole 30 days. So there was a second expedition with a new crew that left Danes Island on Svalbard in 1897. The drag ropes made the balloon dip into the water so these automatically detached, and the crew had to dump ballast. So the balloon was already unsteerable and unstable, and the lightened balloon flew so high it quickly lost hydrogen through the stitching. Not going very well, is it?
was this guy related to Elon Musk?
Possibly, a distant relative. So how do you think the crew communicated with the outside world, this being the end of the 1800s?
It's got to be a pigeon or something.
Yeah.
Pigeon?
Yes, homing
really?
Pigeons.
Really?
Hydrogen pigeons?
What about hydrogen pigeons? No, homing pigeons.
Oh, homing pigeons. Sorry, I'm kind of deaf.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier, about all being deaf. Only one of at least four of the homing pigeons released was picked up. It was found on a Norwegian steamer and shot. But the attached message was retrieved and passed on. They also used messages in steel cylinders which were encased in cork so they would float on the sea, and two of these were found. I don't know how long it took to find them though. Anyway, how did the expedition go? So the balloon was aloft for just 10.5 hours before it was dragged along the ice for a further 41 hours before it became weighed down by rain. So they were stranded on the ice. And diary entries show that from the 14th of July, they trekked south with provisions as far as this island, which I can't pronounce, before they died in October, possibly from polar bear attacks. So the on this day is that in 1930, the remains of the expedition were found.
Wow.
Mm. Now you'd think, well, they weren't really great at exploring and planning and stuff. However, the bodies were recovered, and King Gustav V delivered a narration at the explorer's funeral in Stockholm, and there was a period of national mourning. Now, as a little postscript to this, Ekholm, who was the guy that quit the expedition when he realised this wasn't going to end well, he was an early and eager advocate for anthropogenic climate control and pointed out in 1899 that at present rates, the burning of coal eventually could double the concentration of atmospheric CO2.
Wow.
He was the first person to use the term greenhouse to describe the effects of carbon dioxide on the atmosphere.
Wow.
So lucky that he survived, or that he had the nous to realise not to go on that balloon. So, over to you, David, please, for your On This Day piece.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a bit of a theme about the British press here, from your stuff. So, it just so happened that this date marks a turning point in mass communication that very nearly didn't happen. On August the 6th, 1925, across the Atlantic, there was a storm raging against mankind's greatest ever invention, the bobble off. No, not the bobble off, although it is very good for removing fluff from your underpants, but sounds a bit too Russian. No, I'm talking about the phone booth. Yeah, so imagine this simple invention being at the heart of the very soul of nations. No, me neither. But on the 6th of August 1925, it seemed that American consumers thought that the humble phone booth in the corner of the old general store was the work of the devil, and they wanted it gone. Or did they? Let me read you an extract on public phone booths from the New York Herald on that fateful date, 6th of August 1925. With the growing numbers of public phone booths appearing in general stores around the country, many people are complaining that they do not believe that phone booths are in the public interest and should not be in places where the public wish to shop. I just did that accent in case there were any commissioners from Netflix. So, not exactly strong words of condemnation, are they? Even in 1925, and this article, to be honest, would have probably sunk without a trace. But trust the British press to twist this bland observation into a tornado of hatred. After it appeared in some newspapers across the US without a ripple, it tsunamied across the pond to the offices of the London Daily Mail. And to be fair, they printed it verbatim, but with one tiny difference, a headline which read, "Burn them all!" Not to be outdone, the Daily Express also printed the article verbatim with a headline, "Immigrants to blame!" Of course, the Daily Telegraph sensed it was in danger of looking weak and chipped in with the most contentious headline of all, Stop the Booths. When the Americans got wind of it, they turned on the British in their jumped up little red foam boxes invented by some posh bloke called Gordon Bennett. And America unleashed shock and awe and Walt Disney on an unsuspecting British public. Wait a minute, I hear you say, wait a minute, Walt Disney? What has he ever done to us? And I say, have you seen Home on the Range? So what was the problem with a phone booth in a shop? I mean, it's a little soundproof space that's discreet and functional, like an upright see-through public lavatory stroke coffin. Who doesn't want something that looks like a see-through urinal stroke coffin looming over you, reminding you that death is never very far away and your prostate is the size of a bowling ball, while you're trying to splash the cash on champagne cigars and bobble-offs? Things got so bad in the Battle of the Phone Booths that many people resorted to standing shoulder to shoulder with their arms folded to form a human barrier blocking anyone from getting access to the phone booth. They then set about attacking people with the most outbursts of profanity. And these people became known as rappers. Of course, the number one rule in life is that you don't need much of a reason to go to war. And thanks to the Daily Mail and the Daily Express, the iconic red phone box was now under siege in Britain. Because when America sneezes, they use us for the crook of their arm. Our beautiful red boxes were ripped apart, set alight, and some of them were even thrown under horses during the Derby. Surprisingly, the backlash from Britain led to a complete 360 on phone booths in America. And people went to the general store in their droves and started making a point of using them, sticking two fingers up to the British press, not those two fingers, index and pinky, which eventually became the international call sign for, I'm on the phone! Famous Americans of the Roaring Twenties led the campaign to back the booths. These included Al Capone, Machine Gun Kelly, Greta Garbo, and even Clark Kent, who had recently been caught in a gentleman's toilet, naked, except for a strategically placed rolled-up copy of the Daily Planet. A passerby said he was still holding the front page when they brought him out, even though he was in handcuffs. Any Netflix commissioners in? Of course, there's always winners and losers, and when the Battle of the Phone Booths was over, Al Capone and Machine Gun Kelly got back to completing their perfectly legitimate tax returns. Well, Superman stewed in a cell with a guy called Donald Trump, and they did not hit it off. A case of Superman versus Super Tan. Any Netflix commissioners? So as the years went by, phone booth numbers in the US collapsed like a pack of soggy playing cards found in a wheelie bin. And today there are zero phone booths left in Manhattan, which explains why so many New Yorkers are livid and Superman is up on three counts of public indecency. Things are no better in the UK. Up to 4,000 iconic red phone boxes are now up for adoption. And you could own one for just £1 if your community can find a use for it that doesn't involve it being an emergency public toilet. Phone booths are now repurposed as local libraries and defibrillator stations. And for those of you who don't know what a defibrillator is, it's a device to bring back the dead. So there's still hope for Scottish Labour. In 2023, due to technology and the mass production of the mobile phone, thank you, Chinese child labour. The humble public phone booth is no more, and rings will never be the same again.
Rings.
Thank you. Right, I've got a second on this day piece before we come to you, yourself. Who was the first man in space, and when did he make the trip?
A Russian?
Yep. Yuri Bobolov.
Yuri Gagarin, yes, on 12th of April 1961. Who was the second cosmonaut? If you didn't know the first one, you heard of the second one.
Oh, the bit little dog.
Not the monkey.
Oh, the monkey?
Well,
snake.
I think cosmonaut has to be a human, I think.
All right.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how it works. So I'll tell you anyway. It was Major German Titov. He flew on this day in 1961, and he broke a number of records in the process. What kind of records do you think he broke? He was the second man in space.
I had a dirty joke.
You're improvising. Yeah.
First man to eat a full Scottish breakfast in space.
No.
First one to take a wrong turn.
Going the wrong way around the world.
Yeah.
No.
First one to call a phone booth.
Yeah.
From space.
Yeah. Any other ideas, or should I give you a long list of stuff that you achieved? So he was the first person to orbit the Earth multiple times, so he did that 17 times. He was the first person to pilot a spaceship, which is quite cool. He was the first person to spend more than a day in space, so he managed 25.3 hours. He was the first person to sleep in orbit. He slept for roughly one orbit and was surprised to wake with his arms floating in the air because of the absence of gravity. He suffered from space sickness, so he became the first person to vomit in space. So the opposite of the Scottish breakfast. However, on his return flight for debriefing, he alarmed the medical staff by opening and downing a beer, which was in complete violation of the rules. He was the first photographer from space, making the first manual photographs from orbit, thus setting a record for modern first photos of Earth in space. And he was the first person to film the Earth using a professional movie camera, which he used for 10 minutes. I mentioned earlier that Andre's ill-fated balloon was called the Ernan, or Eagle, and Titov's call sign was also Eagle.
Yeah.
Nice little thing there. Over to you, Dr. Anthony, please, for your on this day piece. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. And my name is Dr. Anthony Drew, but I'm not a medical doctor. I'm just a PhD in applied linguistics, which is about as useless as it comes, okay? Never really good at history. So my on this day, it just so happened that on August 6th, 1967, my oldest brother Andrew was born. So happy birthday, Andrew. And he is, by definition, a conspiracy theorist. So, and paranoia runs in our family, so I'm going to give you the most paranoid conspiracy theory of this day that I can possibly muster. So I too am a little paranoid, so every time I walk into a room, I know everyone is looking at me and talking about me, but I also have an overinflated ego, so they're only saying how fabulous I am. All right. So, and I also have terrible handwriting. So my conspiracy theory about this day, I think the most important thing on this day was that Lucille Ball was born. Do you know who she is? Yes, okay, I'm sure you do. So she is the person why, and she is probably the reason why on this day the US bombed Hiroshima on this day in 1945. So Lucille Ball was born in 1911 and the US bombed Hiroshima in 1945. If you average those 2 years, you get 1928, which is the year Andy Warhol was born on this day. Now, what does Andy Warhol have to do with all of that? I have no idea. But we'll get to it in a minute. So his work flourished in the 60s in a post-war era. You can't have a post-war era without a bombing. Okay? So that's how those are connected. This conspiracy theory is just phenomenal. So it was terribly dark for the U.S. from 1945 until 1951, when then President Harry Truman suggested that America needed to laugh. They needed a funny distraction from the post-war blues, so he, along with members of Congress, thought up the idea to put a funny lady on TV named Lucille Ball. Now, a redhead married to a Latino was really, really ahead of its time. And before you know it, Americans were like, hero what? They forgot about Hiroshima completely. So now, listen. The most important thing about a conspiracy theory is you have to believe it thoroughly. I don't know if you know this, but America does have a history of racism. Actually, we have a currency of it too. You know, it's currently happening. But two opposing racist events occurred on August 6th. One, In 1916, the United States bans watermelons on all army bases, which is inherently racist to anybody who likes watermelons. And I think that's most of us. The problem was they couldn't figure out a way to dispose of them without getting flies. So now we're offending flies, because why can't they be flying around the watermelon rinds? You know, it's just ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. Now, to make up for it, in 1965, the voting rights became a law in the United States, signed in by, the voting rights came in for women and people of color in 1965. The irony was, these laws were passed in the 1800s, but nobody really did anything about it until 1965. They basically just forgot about it until Lyndon B. Johnson signed in the voting rights on August 6, 1965. That's if you believe Lyndon B. Johnson won the election fairly. Some people, he stole it right out from under what's-his-face, but on August 6th, so I digress, okay? Getting back to I Love Lucy, on this day in 1926, Gertrude Ederle was the first woman to swim across the English Channel. She did it in 14 hours, 34 minutes. What does this have to do with I Love Lucy? I'll tell you. She was going to audition for the part of Ethel, but was too tired. So Vivian Vance got the role, born in Kansas, and again, nothing to do with August 6th. Finally, on August 6th, 1881, Scottish native and scientist Alexander Fleming was born. And I don't know if you know this, he won the Nobel Prize for inventing antibiotics, which we all know is the reason why children have autism. We also know that antibiotics are good for getting rid of gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis, which is going to be the title of my autobiography. A few more things about August 6th. In 1930, and also I never did well in history because of things like this. I just turned it into creative writing class. So thank you very much for the opportunity. In 1935, cryogenics Dr. Ralph Willard froze a monkey named Jekyll and brought him back to life. 30 years later, in 1965, on this day, the Beatles released the album Help, which is what the monkey said when he was being frozen. I'm sorry, what he thought. Monkeys don't talk. Not in this conspiracy theory. But what does this have to do with today? I'll tell you what it has to do with today. All of this leads to, on this day, in 2011, the United States credit rating was lowered for the first time. And a year later, the Mars rover landed on Mars using the same studios they filmed the moon landing. And ironically enough, the rover's name was Lucille Ball.
Thank you. Can I quick show of hands, who is from Edinburgh in the audience? So. Oh, not very many. Okay, that's good. So we might get away with some facts and figures. It's the second half of the show, the history of Edinburgh. So I'm going to introduce some topics, I'm going to ask some questions, and you can give your best guesses or possibly knowledge. You're the Edinburgh expert here, Veronica, aren't you? There are many cities in the world which claim to be built on seven hills, including Edinburgh. Can you name some of the others in the world?
Lisbon?
This is where I go, I don't know, because it's not on my list, but yeah, quite possibly.
It's very hilly.
Yeah.
Rome.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a well-known one, isn't it?
Newark, New Jersey.
Is that true?
I don't know. San Francisco.
It is, yes. As is any other American ones? You're getting fed answers.
Denver. No.
I should have got a comprehensive list, shouldn't I? So on my list is Washington, D.C., apparently.
Oh, well.
And this place in Ohio called Seven Hills. Uh-huh. Who'd have thought?
I wonder what that looks like.
Also, around the world, we've got places like Jerusalem, Athens, Tehran, Prague, and Kyiv.
Sydney has a suburb called Seven Hills.
Yeah, this could end up a very long discussion. So my point is that basically...
I don't know whether there are any hills there.
Right, yeah, so my point is that Edinburgh is actually not that special, even though it thinks it's built on seven hills. Marika, I'm sorry, pressure's on you now. Can you name Edinburgh's seven hills?
Okay.
Or indeed.
Arthur's Seat.
Yes.
Calton Hill.
Yes.
Blackford Hill.
Yes.
Then it gets difficult.
Dopey, that's sneezing.
That thing with the castle on it.
Castle Hill?
Castle Rock, yes. And so you've got three more. Shall I tell you? So it's Braid Hill, Castorfin Hill, and Craig Lockett. So Arthur's Seat is a hill just to the east of Edinburgh city centre, 822 feet above sea level, which is in fact an ancient volcanic plug. The lava has been dated to about 340 million years old. How did Arthur's Seat get its name? Any ideas?
A big donation from Arthur.
I'm completely clueless. It's probably something really easy.
I think is the answer, but there's various rumours about what it could be. Mm. King Arthur had a seat here.
Something like that, yeah. As vague as that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's also an 18th century historian called William Maitland proposed that the name was a corruption of something Gaelic, which I can't say, and that was the height of arrows was the translation, so that doesn't really tell you anything in itself. Right, are we good at geology at all? Is it worth asking you?
Yes, totally.
How did the nearby cliffs known as Salisbury Crags form?
There was a big bang, wasn't there?
You're going too far back now.
Pangaea. Pangaea, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, when it split? The great split
right.
of the continents, the great divide.
Yeah.
You
know. No. It was formed.
I agree.
So it's formed by a glacier which moved west to east during the past 2 million years and it took material along with it and that exposed the crags that you can see today. How did the local geology informed the so-called father of modern geology, James Hutton? And I don't expect you to know the answer. But
I'm glad about that.
Hutton advanced the idea that the physical world's remote history can be inferred from evidence in present-day rocks. In a particular area of the crags, known as Hutton's section, he observed that the magma had forced its way through the sedimentary rocks above it to form what we see today. So this helped him develop the theory that geological features are not static, but undergo continuing transformation over extremely long periods of time. And from this he argued that the Earth was basically more than 6,000 years old, which was the prevailing thought at the time. Right, let's try something potentially easier. How is Edinburgh's monument known as the National Monument to the Fallen of the Napoleonic Wars, better known? In fact, where is it? I'm sorry for the American...
Great Amongi. That's French, isn't it?
Interesting.
I don't know.
So it's known as Edinburgh's Disgrace. It can be found on Calton Hill, and it's this half-finished, basically, building based on the design of the Parthenon that you can see up there. So it was started in 1822. The foundation stone apparently was laid by George IV. I found that quite... I don't think he did it personally, basically.
I believe he hurt his back.
Yes, he would have done. Because it was six tons of stone. The plans for a memorial of the past and incentive to the future heroism of the men of Scotland, sorry women, were drawn up by William Playfair and designed to emulate the appearance of the Parthenon on the Athenian Acropolis. But it would operate as a church and have catacombs underneath. Why the Parthenon when it's Edinburgh in Scotland?
Because didn't we nick everything from Greece at one time?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I'll come to that in a moment. Yeah.
I think it's because they call it the Athens of the North.
Yes. So it was a kind of Enlightenment time, 1820s. So the leading man behind the campaign to get that building designed was Thomas Bruce, the 7th Earl of Elgin.
Right.
And what does Elgin give you a clue to?
The Elgin thieving herd of people that get away with it because they're very posh. Marbles.
The Elgin marbles. The same guy.
And these are all real words you're saying?
Yes. Right. Here's an easy guess the answer question. So how much money, this is in pounds sterling, do you think was needed to be raised to build this new monument? think this is in the 1820s, given inflation and everything. Mm-hmm. That's
20.
£20?
Yeah. I don't know, inflation.
It must be shillings.
£1 million.
£1 million, okay. Anything in between might get you the right answer.
456 trillion shillings and a farthing.
No, £42,000 was needed to be raised by public subscription. So they started construction, good project management, in 1826 with only a third of the amount raised, and they basically couldn't raise the rest. So they abandoned the project with it half finished in 1829. So you've got this half finished Parthenon monument. Over the years, people have thought, oh, well, actually, maybe we could finish the monument by making it into what sort of things, do you think?
HS2?
I think they'd knock it down, wouldn't they, rather than build it on.
A beer garden.
Beer garden, yeah.
A discotheque.
Discotheque. Right, yeah. I like your ideas better than these. So, a monument to Queen Victoria when she died in 1901. Something commemorating the 1707 Act of Union with England. In 1907.
Oh, that's a great idea.
I don't know how that. I don't know why that wasn't popular. A new Scottish National Gallery in 1907, and a Scottish Parliament building in 1908, so ahead of its time, and also a memorial to those who fell in the Great War in 1918. So you've got this unfinished building. Glasgow Council then offered to help. What was the condition that they put on completion of this building?
We'll help you finish it, as long as we can move it to Glasgow after.
that sounds about right, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They said, we'll offer to help you complete this monument as long as we can have our coat of arms on it.
Oh.
And Edinburgh declined for some reason. Hence one of the other names of the building, which is the Pride and the Poverty. So where was an actual full-scale replica of the Parthenon built and completed in 1897. You might know this, possibly.
A full-scale monument of, always repeat the question, divide yourself time.
Of the Parthenon.
Of the Parthenon.
Yeah.
I'm ignoring this one. Newark, New Jersey.
Oh. Well, apparently it was in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Nashville, Tennessee.
And it was to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the state. Yeah, you can be on the panel next time. I only know
because I just went to Nashville and saw it. Oh, okay. Last year.
Brilliant. Okay, right, a different topic. It's a very long question, this. I'm sorry about this, so concentrate carefully. What happened in 1916 which made the Keeper of the Great Seal of Scotland move the regalia of Scotland from the Crown Room in Edinburgh Castle to one of the castle vaults? This is 1916.
I'm gonna guess bombings. Like there was two. Like they might cave in, and therefore they moved them to the crypts. You said, or to the
vaults.
To
yeah,
the vaults,
yeah. So bombings. And what was novel about these bombings?
Well, it was kind of novel to have bombings.
Yes, yes, it was. Yeah, fairly common. So
yeah,
it was German air raids,
yeah.
But it was something novel about the type of air raids that were taking place.
Balloons.
You can't help yourself, can you?
Zeppelins.
Yeah, the Zeppelins, that's right, yeah. So it was carried out by two Zeppelins on the night of the 2nd to 3rd of April 1916. They dropped 7 incendiary and 17 high explosive bombs on Leith and the city of Edinburgh. 13 people died and 24 were injured. The White Hart Hotel in the Grassmarket and the County Hotel in Lothian Road suffered substantial damage, as well as a number of tenement buildings in Newington. There's a flagstone in the Grassmarket which marks the spot where a bomb landed in front of the White Hart Inn, making a 9 by 6 foot crater. Well, let's see if my fringe show in the Grassmarket can make as big an impact as that. So the White Hart Inn. Parts of that building date back to 1516, making it the oldest pub in Edinburgh. Now, it also claims to be the most haunted, which I don't think is true, because there's the Banshee Labyrinth, isn't
there?
Yeah,
lots of pubs claim that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how you prove what is the most haunted, really.
I looked at this, and there's been lots of paranormal investigators there. And the thing they come up with most is, oh, we felt a temperature drop. It got really cold. And then I felt a tingling sensation. Well, that's because you're scared, you know. So that was the kind of sum total of the science, I think.
During the fringe, there'd be a temperature increase, wouldn't there?
Yeah.
Any ghost stories from over there? Or?
I do know a statistic on this.
Yes, go.
The number one creator of ghosts is alcoholism. I learned that on a ghost tour in New York City. Yeah.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Who stayed at the White Hart Inn during his last visit to Edinburgh in 1791 and there bid farewell to his lover Agnes Nancy McAlose before she left for Jamaica? I don't know if I said that right.
Well,
1791.
Considering Robert Burns has been in every pub in Scotland, I would say Robert Burns.
It was, yes, yes. And Nancy was the inspiration for which of Burns' poems? Her Leaving.
Hmm.
It was A Fond Kiss.
Yeah.
He sent her a copy. you know it well. You know it well. He sent her a copy of the manuscript after their final meeting. Now, in 1803, William and Dorothy Wordsworth also stayed at the White Hart Inn while on their tour of Scotland. Now, given that this is in the Grassmarket, how do you think Dorothy described the pub in an early version of TripAdvisor?
Minging.
She said?
Minging.
Minging.
2 stars, no Wi-Fi.
Harrowing.
Harrowing. Well, she described it as not noisy and tolerably cheap. How times have changed. Right, different topic again. Maybe we can get you in on this, Dr. Chansey.
If any of this is even real.
This is just a figment of your alcoholism.
Exactly.
Yes. Who was Greyfriars Bobby?
Is that a police officer?
Sounds like it.
Yeah. Oh, we just looked up Greyfriars today for something.
For the Kirkyard.
We're going to the grave there.
Ah, yeah. Yes.
We'll
be coming to that.
Mm-hmm.
If
there.
It's time, we'll come to that, yeah.
You'll see him there. There's a statue of him.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Of
the little dog.
Yeah. And specifically what dog? Or what kind of dog?
Scottish dog? What are they called? Mm-hmm.
It's
a Westie.
Well, a Skye Terrier dog. And people get very upset about whether you say the right breed or not. So you have to say Skye Terrier. I'll come to that. So he became known for spending 14 years guarding the grave of his owner in the kirkyard until the dog died in 1872. Bobby's headstone was placed by the Dog Aid Society at the kirkyard's entrance in 1981. What spot does this mark?
X.
But the dog is on Twitter.
X marks the spot.
It's not Twitter anymore.
Twitter.
Yeah. It doesn't mark any particular spot, but many visitors think that's where he and therefore the owner are buried, but the grave is actually unmarked.
I heard a rumour that Greyfriars Bobby was actually a Great Dane, but the council just didn't have enough bronze.
Okay. A bit like the monument on Carlton Hill then.
Who owned Bobby?
Greyfriar? No
one's entirely sure. So the two contemporary accounts which contradict each other, but both were owners who could have been called John Grey. So one was a night watchman, another one was a farmer. In 19th century Europe, there are over 60 documented accounts of graveyard or cemetery stray dogs who were fed by visitors and curators to the point that the dogs made the graveyards their home. And then people began to believe that they were waiting by a grave, so then the dog was looked after. And that's how these things kind of developed. Mm. There was an article that appeared in The Scotsman, which set this thing off in Edinburgh. Visitor numbers increased, and then people thought, locals, a way of making money. Also, this author, Jan Bonderson, speculates that the original Bobby died and was then replaced with a younger dog so they could keep this going. and that explains why the dogs seem to live for so long. The 1912 novel Greyfriars Bobby by the American author Ellen Atkinson popularised the story in the US, and her version of the story is the one which is most familiar to people today. Now, why might that be surprising or not surprising? Big sigh over there.
Big sigh.
Yeah. Because basically the author had never visited Scotland. And she embellished much of the story from her own imagination, and yet that's the story which has caught on. How did the English philanthropist Lady Burdett Coutts choose to commemorate Bobby after he died?
She had him stuffed.
I like that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Really?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm barely following.
Open the pub.
Yeah.
Is it?
No. I just like your answers. I like the answers. They're better than the She commissioned a drinking fountain, which is the statue you can see at the top of Candlemaker Row there. So there was an upper fountain for humans and a lower fountain for dogs, and Bobby's statue's on the top. Unfortunately, due to health scares, Edinburgh Council decided to close all the drinking fountains around 1975. But what's unusual about this monument in Edinburgh?
You can touch it.
You can, yes.
Without being arrested.
Because the nose is quite shiny now, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, so everyone touches its nose. Millions of people touch its nose, it's going all shiny.
Which, even since COVID. Mm. Yeah.
There's another statue in Edinburgh, I think it's David Hume, where everybody touches his big toe.
Because that's about all he can reach. Yeah. There, isn't he? He's so high up. But, yeah. Any thoughts on... It's actually Edinburgh's smallest listed building.
Wait, a building? The statue is a building?
Well, it's a monument. I don't really know what the definition is here, but that's what I read.
Okay.
So it may be untrue because it's on the internet.
Just
so.
Imagine a little door in it.
Yes. You can climb up it.
Family of mice.
Yeah.
Yeah, in 1984, the monument or building had to be restored and reinstated after it was hit by a car. How was the 2006 film The Adventures of Greyfriars Bobby controversial? I've hinted at this earlier.
The dog didn't consent to being an actor.
They didn't use the right dog.
Exactly.
Exactly.
The part of Bobby was given to a West Highland White Terrier. Which led to protests from the Skye Terrier Breed Club.
I bet the Daily Mail was livid.
Christopher Figg, the producer, said that a Westie was used because its white coat would stand out in the dark and because its eyes would not be hidden from the camera by a fringe. So there we go. I've checked this out and it's not true, so I'll just say I read that there is a sign at the kirkyard's entrance which says, "No dogs allowed." I went in and checked and there isn't a sign saying that, so I'm quite disappointed by that, to say. Right, so we've just got time to fit in one more thing. So we'll talk about one person buried in Greyfriars Kirkyard, so see if we can find him later. It was William McGonagall.
Ah.
What do we know about him?
His wife worked at Hogwarts. Harry Potter fan.
I can't say no because it's not in my notes.
Okay.
So
it's actually like if you do the Harry Potter tour, the walking tour, they'll take you to the graveyard, and because J.K. Rowling was walking around that graveyard quite a lot, and she got inspiration from the names from the graveyard, and that's one of them.
That's
so you were actually not incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
And did any of the ghosts sue?
No. they might, but it's Warner Bros, so, you know, it's hard. I actually know this. He's known as the worst poet. Like, the world's worst poet, I think.
Well, that's even worse than I've got here. Just an extremely bad poet is what I've got to say. He was an Irish-born Scottish weaver, actor, and extremely bad poet. McGonagall moved to Edinburgh in 1895. His only apparent understanding of poetry was his belief that it needed to rhyme. So a great example was his poem about the Tay Bridge disaster. I'm sure you all remember that one. So that starts off as, "Beautiful railway bridge of the silvery Tay, alas, I am very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time." Incidentally, modern sources give the death toll as 75, and he says 90. And he finished the poem by saying, "I must now conclude my lay by telling the world fearlessly, without the least dismay, that your central girders would not have given way, at least many sensible men do say, had they been supported on each side with buttresses, at least many sensible men confesses. For the stronger we our houses do build, the less chance we have of being killed." We're impressed, aren't we? Yes, good. This is probably going to be about the final question, given the time. On one occasion, his workmates paid for a local theatre owner to allow him to appear in the title role in a production of Macbeth. How did the play go wrong in the final act?
Someone got killed?
The stage collapsed.
It's actually about McGonagall himself that...
He got booed.
He got booed, well... So he was convinced that the actor playing Macduff was jealous of him, so he refused to die. McGonagall died above what is now the Captain's Bar in Edinburgh's South College Street. He was not surprisingly penniless when he died in 1902. Couldn't sell his poems. So I'm going to have to go on to the final words. So just given the time and estimating how much we can run over, I think now is a good time, please, for you to thank the guests that we saw today and heard. Marijke Kortenbach, David Cruikshanks and Dr. Anthony Drew. I'd like to thank the Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the Hill Street Theatre for hosting us today. The next show will be tomorrow, 7th of August, in this same space at 10:45. Guests, you now have 30 up to 60 seconds to plug anything you're doing at the Fringe or anything else you'd like to tell people. So we'll start with Marijke. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, so I'm in a show called TBC Improv, Absolute Improv. We do short form improv games like Whose Line Is It Anyway, if you've seen that show on TV. That's on at 7:45 every day at the space on the Mile. And tickets, if you want to know more about that, you can ask me after the show.
Thank you. Are you ready? Yep.
You got boy, am I coming out the traps. I don't have a show this year, but I've written a book. It's called Staying Alive. Ooh. And it's about my 40-year journey with PTSD and how I've stayed alive this long, which is a bit of a miracle. On sale today for the much-reduced price of a tenner.
Ooh. I'm looking for gigs, so if anyone can put me up on a show, but I say go to these two shows, buy the book, and go to the improv. Yeah.
Thank you. And a quick plug for my own solo stand-up show. If you like one-liners and puns, I'm doing a show every day at 12:45 in the Beehive Inn, just down from that White Hart Inn in the Grass Market, every day up until the 27th, but not the 16th, and it's called Richard Pulsford Short Joke Teller. So, I've got a final on this day piece, which I've just got time to do. So today marks the death of Anne Hathaway, William Shakespeare's wife, in 1623.
Well, I thought you meant the actress.
You're okay.
Sorry.
You're okay. Where's that defibrillator? Can I keep going now?
Yes.
You're right. Do you need a glass of water? in 1623. Don't know if you heard that bit. Yeah. Also on this day in 1637, the playwright and one-time poet laureate Ben Jonson died. Not the athlete, no. Age 65. So the famous quote from Ben's, the one we probably all heard of, is, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions." Yeah. Here are some great quotes from him with which to end the show. So I've got three here. So number one, "There is no greater hell than to be a prisoner of fear." Number two, "Success produces confidence. Confidence relaxes industry, and negligence ruins the reputation which accuracy had raised." So if your shows are going too well. And number three, I think he was also a wise user of social media. As he said, "True happiness consists not in the multitude of friends, but in the worth and choice." Actually, I've got a fourth one, just to end. Sorry about that. This is like Spanish Inquisition, isn't it? Finally, he bemoaned, "Oh, for an engine to keep back all clocks, or make the sun forget his motion." Unfortunately, no such engine has yet been invented, so we must now say goodbye.
Aww.
Thank you.